Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Today I'm very honored to have as my guest Marilyn Robinson, the author most recently of Gilead, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. She's the author as well of one previous novel, Housekeeping, a work of nonfiction, Mother Country, and a book of essays, The Death of Adam. I've been wanting to talk to Marilyn Robinson since Housekeeping came out, because it had one of those things, people don't believe it, but, you know, an opening paragraph that was so beautiful and so complex in its genealogy that I felt I had to read the book. Gilead is no less complex, and I thought I'd begin by asking Marilyn Robinson to read the first paragraph. This is my guest, Marilyn Robinson, reading from her novel Gilead.
I told you last night that I might be gone sometime, and you said, "Where?" And I said, "To be with the good Lord." And you said, "Why?" And I said, "Because I'm old." And you said, "I don't think you're old." And you put your hand in my hand and you said, "You aren't very old," as if that settled it. I told you you might have a very different life from mine and from the life you've had with me, and that would be a wonderful thing. There are many ways to live a good life. And you said, "Mama already told me that." And then you said, "Don't laugh," because you thought I was laughing at you. You reached up and put your fingers on my lips and gave me that look I never in my life saw on any other face beside your mother's. It's a kind of furious pride, very passionate and stern. I'm always a little surprised to find my eyebrows unsinged after I've suffered one of those looks. I will miss them.
Marilyn Robinson, reading from the first paragraph of Gilead. Now, we enter not knowing who these speakers are, and to a situation where we're trying to imagine where we are immediately. Because that happens fairly easily in this book, I still want to assert that you enter the book into a realm of mystery, a realm that pre-exists the reader's entrance, and that the reader is finding his way in this book. And because the narrator, a minister, John Ames, is talking to his son, he's not guiding the reader, because this book is written entirely in a state of intimacy and silence. There are things that he assumes his son will know that don't need to be said, and there are things his son doesn't know that no reader can fit immediately into without coming to know these people. And so I first wanted to ask you if you could describe the intimacy of this novel.
I think that a sort of question that focused the novel for me, that was central from the beginning, was the question of how one absolutely loved. And I thought of when a man has a child, when a parent or a good parent has a child, their presence when they're with you as children makes you feel that under no circumstance could you ever cease to love them. Under no circumstance could you ever cease to forgive them. You know, that what they are is a fact of their existence and not a fact of any particular behavior or attitude or crime even, you know. And that this very pure understanding of the kind of sacred significance of another human being simply as such is something that can become attenuated, or that you don't understand when you look outside your own relationships that are of that kind and see other people walking through the world misbehaving, all that sort of thing. So in a sense, I mean, there are two narratives going on. In one case, he's pondering the profundity of his love for his young son. On the other hand, he sees his dear old friend struggling with his love for his son, you know, who's an adult, who's in his 40s, you know. And so it's, in a way, it's that difference that he's imagining himself across. I do not know you as an adult man. Whatever you are, I love you. I do not, you know, I could never not love you.
The speaker is the Reverend John Ames. He knows his doctrine, he knows his scripture, he knows his theology, and he's a literate minister.
Yes.
He's read Karl Barth. He knows enough, he's speaking in 1956, to recommend that the people around him not bother with transgression, that they don't have to bring the André Gide novels to him. So he's speaking in a state of knowledge of the things he would know in his role, but in his limitedness as a human, that those things, although he has more instruction, more collegial asides to look toward, he's every bit as fallible as the son he hopes to instruct, and he seems to want to instruct his son in his own fallibility.
Yes, that is certainly true. One of the things that he comes from a particular theological tradition, and one of the things that it assumes is that that everyone is utterly fallible. But that's the sort of human problem. It's as if there's a discourse between what is true and what is humanly knowable, and that there's a continuous sort of struggling across the frontiers of these things, you know. So that, I mean, the sense of vision or revelation that would occur to him and be most important is precisely the discovery of his own error, you know. So that it's not error in a static sense. It's error as one half of a dynamic of realization, which is never final, of course, and never perfectly or even substantially correct itself, you know.
Now, you've said in a lecture on narration that most fiction is itself about a character who comes to know his false relation to truth, to reality, to others, and that in, to a religious sensibility, this is the state of man in the world. That to some extent, a novelist writing about this consciously and unconsciously is replicating something sacred about the creative act, in that he's recreating the mystery of error.
Yes.
That a human lives in.
Yes, I think that's very true. And I think that, it's a beautiful idea, because it sanctifies error. It removes guilt from error, in a sense, because it gives the strenuousness to consciousness and allows for new discovery, you know.
Well, it also has a corollary that all evidence is potentially false evidence.
Mm-hmm.
That most scientists think of evidence as being the grounds for proof. But in the novel, as in God's world as imagined by the novel, all evidence is false in order to compel belief.
Hmm. I would like to hear you expand on that a little.
That we don't know, that because we don't know, we're looking at the world as a possible revelation, but what it reveals is something we have to believe in rather than have proven to us.
Yes, certainly. And I think that also, in a way, to my mind, in the way that John Ames thinks, what is revealed in consciousness and not simply an outward experience, you know, that what he can discover out of memory or out of misapprehension is also instructive. It's, you know, I mean, that truth, it's not like a true-false dichotomy of some sort, but that there's a sort of manifestation of an aesthetic authority that is, that makes meaning cohere.
Now, here we are in 1956, which is the present tense of the book. Mm-hmm. The narrator, 76 years old approximately, is writing a notebook for his 7-year-old son to someday read. In point of fact, the son today would be around 51 years old, mm-hmm. if it is so good for him to have lasted this long. And he is writing the book because he's been told that he has a heart problem, angina pectoris, which, being a minister, has the cadence for him of misericordia. Mm-hmm. So he is someone who takes what he's told by a doctor and hears in it the cadences of his vocation.
Yes.
Now, I would say that the first level of the book is kind of Edenic, that what convinces most readers of the beauty of entering this world is his various visual perceptions of a cat jumping for soap bubbles, of the light as it streaks a child's hair and catches the face, that there is something for him that proves the existence of God in the world, and that is beauty. Mm-hmm. Now, the narrator frequently says or fears that the pulpit is speaking.
Yes.
In this notebook that he's keeping. Are there times when you feel that as a writer, that the understructure is coming up from below?
Well, you know, actually, I felt so engrossed writing this book. I felt so strongly that I knew this character, John Ames, and I was so mystified by him because I thought I would write a book from a woman's point of view, as I had done before. I assumed these. I thought I couldn't write from a man's point of view. And then suddenly, here he was, you know, telling me what he was telling me. I mean, I've never in my life, my odd life, had a stronger feeling of actually the presence of the character, like a self-induced delusion, you know. Who knows all about baseball? What a surprise, you know. In any case, So from my point of view, I felt less as if I were speaking through him than I felt that I was speaking through Ruth, certainly, you know. But there is the coincidence that he and I have many interests in common. He and I both belong to a tradition where speculative religious thought is perfectly respectable. It's very non-dogmatic. You can wonder all you want to within these large categories, you know. The thing that if I were preaching in that novel, the thing I was would have been preaching is, isn't it beautiful? Look at water. Look at light. Isn't it beautiful? You know, I think that if there's any blessing I would want to put upon the world, it is that people understand where they are and what they're surrounded by. You know, and the situation of the novel let me ponder that and articulate it.
Yes, but I'm speaking to Marilyn Robinson on the occasion of the publication of her novel Gilead. Yes, but as I read, only after I read Gilead, the essays in The Death of Adam, mm-hmm. I became aware that what I thought of as a mystical, lyrical, moon-maddened writer has a mind of great dexterity and power to persuade. It's very sharp and logical and orderly. So I wondered whether you can... how does that mind write such miraculous, air-chastened, light-glorified fiction?
It's an interesting thing. It truly, physiologically, the experience of writing fiction is different from the experience of writing nonfiction for me. Both of them I love to do. I think that they nourish each other. But it truly is another mind. That's sort of what it feels like. It's a bizarre thing to say.
But do you think it is really? For instance, in housekeeping, the girls go on a kind of night sea journey across a lake, and they're going to come mysteriously to a kind of transcendental vision of creation, of the formation of crystals, and of fecund multiplication. I mean, it's an extraordinary vision that they have. In Gilead, the boy goes with his father, also on an expedition, this one a desert expedition in a drought, and he's going to have a vision of that has to do with whether death is finality. The father, in this case, is trying to bury his father, who won't stay buried,
yes.
Who lives beyond the grave in the life of the son. But nevertheless, this voyage in both books occupies the same kind of role. It seems to me meaningful that for the women it's water, for the men it's earth, and parched earth at that. Again, it seems as if even if that mind is not operating on the surface in a knowing way, it's everywhere at work, ordering and preparing a vision of the world that is very consistent.
I think you're probably right. I do. One of the things that I have been interested to do in my life is make a vision of the world that pleased me. You know what I mean? I feel as if I've been building and expanding my vision of the world. Sometimes I write it down. Sometimes I don't, you know. But it's very important to me. It's not it is the central product of my life, and anything else that I produce is secondary, you know. So it's not surprising to me that there is that kind of basic coherency in what I write, because it's what I believe. I mean, it seems, I would say as a statement of fact, that the reality is dazzling, you know, and that the capacity of human perception is dazzling, and that these things exist in a very profound and beautiful relationship with each other. And I think that the centrality of that conviction is so intense for me that anything I do will reflect it. It's what interests me. It's what I love, you know.
Now, one of the people who was at one point your teacher devoted an entire book to what he called the principles of design and debris. That was John Hawkes. And it seems to me that your perhaps advance or at least expansion of that is that design and debris are part of one order, that they're not opposed to one another, that design and debris, like truth and falsehood, are part of God's order,
yes.
And that until we see them as part of a continuum, we're forced into a dualism that sees them as opposites, and that the great marvel of these books is that whether the narrators know it or not, they inherit a sense of an expanded order that contains more straight across than the divided consciousness of most narrators.
I certainly hope that's true. It certainly describes what I would hope for.
How does that vision come about in you? Because while it seems to me that you've convinced me that there are some books that I need to read, I want to read Feuerbach now. I'm actually going to get Volume 2 of Calvin, not this like Volume 1. But it seems to me that you know, it's Thoreau, it's Emerson, that the poetic version of that vision is in the transcendentalist movement. Is that correct?
I think you're exactly right. The 19th century Americans are my great love. I took a wonderful American literature course in college, a brilliant professor, and I felt as if what was going on in that literature was so brilliant that I couldn't believe that it sort of closed down, you know? And I was quite conscious in housekeeping of wishing to prove to myself the meaningfulness of that method, which is simply deep perception and understanding experience as having, you know, endless implication and beautiful. I mean, everything finally being resolvable.
Now, it seemed to me in particular there that Thoreau was of great importance because of the way words would move up and down in ways that I can't quite explain, except to say that at their higher order they become emblems of something divine. At the lower order they become puns, and they kind of move up and down all the time throughout the narrative. But how did you learn to word that perception?
I don't know. I don't know how the mind learns, you know. I mean, language, you know, comes before any kind of self-consciousness, really, or anything like that. You're already adept as a young child, you know, and who knows? One of the things that's so wonderful, I think, about writing is that you do have access to parts of your mind that you would never experience otherwise. And one of the things that you find out is that there's a massive amount of vocabulary, association, you know, sensuous observation of very close kind, you know.
I wondered whether either of these novels is meant by their author, I can speak for the reader, to provide a kind of conversion experience.
If to the extent that I could say that's true, what I want to convert people to is an appreciation what they are and where they are. I mean, that I consider that to be the first sacred understanding, you know, what a mind is, what perception is, what the world is, you know. Certainly, yes, what memory is. I mean, what a miraculous and strange thing emotional memory is, you know, and how it is the freight, it's the person, you know what I mean? It's beautiful, it's amazing.
But in the essays, for instance, because there's a question that makes me cry, you ask, why would you choose to be willing to live in a world that wants to deprive you of both sensual and spiritual comfort and of cultural succor? Why would you accept this, you say, without demur?
I think that's a very live question. And of course, I mean, in my saying that I want to convert people to an appreciation of what they are and where they are, I'm saying that they lack those things, I think, in many cases, that somehow we do culturally collaborate in depriving ourselves, one another, of these most primary things. And, you know, I'm not, I mean, I've read way back in, you know, it's not nostalgia. It's not as if people haven't always done this to themselves, you know. But at the same time, when you look back through the whole texts of human experience, you can see there is so much that's beautiful and so much that's rich that we can, you know, it should accumulate for us like wealth. And in fact, we impoverish ourselves for no reason, you know. for no reason.
But I feel reading these books, I come away, if I want to stop crying at what's been lost, I come away with the feeling that in order to have these things back, that God has to enter, that that is the belief out of which these books are written, that these books are part of an argument whose answer is God.
Well, you know, I think, very religious. I mean, in the sense that as a deep, essential part of my sense of reality, I believe in God. Not even knowing what the phrase means, you know. I think that I suppose, I mean, one of the reasons that, to a certain extent, I hesitate to talk about it in a direct way is because this kind of language has been so cheapened. And I don't want to imply that I know what it means to believe in God. I think that, for example, I think that the absence that people feel defines God for them. You know what I mean? That to have the sense of lack or deprivation is to have the sense of the thing lacked. Housekeeping is about that to some extent, you know. In other words, I don't believe that most people are totally ignorant or lacking, even in the sense of making the criticism of themselves that they are. And I think that if you assume that you have control of these questions, that you know what it is to believe in God, that you know what God is, in any, that you're wrong, you know, so that the people who are most believing and the people who perhaps think of themselves as not believing are probably much closer to each other, you know, and then the people that truly are insensitive to the question are like the people on the other end who are totally confident that they have the answer.
I've been speaking to Marilynne Robinson about her new novel, Gilead, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. We've been speaking as well about Housekeeping, her first novel, and about her book of essays, The Death of Adam. Thank you very much for joining me.
Okay, welcome. Pleasure.
You can read an excerpt from Gilead on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword bookworm. Copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.